ever stop to think about the world of duck calls? I mean, they seem pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't think there's much to them.
But you know what? There's a whole lot more going on beneath the surface. Today, we're going to dive into a legal case, Primos v. Hunter Specialties, that shows just how complex things can get, even with something as seemingly simple as a duck call.
Absolutely. This case from 2006, it went all the way to the Federal Circuit. And it really gets into the nitty-gritty of patent law. It's like a master class in how patents work in the real world, you know, with all the legal battles and everything.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener for anyone interested in law or innovation. Because we see how, like, these companies, they go head-to-head over these tiny design details. It's all about intellectual property.
It really is. In this case, it's a perfect example of how some really core principles of patent law, like claim construction and the doctrine of equivalence, they actually play out in real-world scenarios. Stuff you'd learn in law school, but seeing it in action is a whole other level.
Totally. And that's exactly what we're here to do today. We're going to break down this Primos v. Hunter's specialties decision, figure out what the court was thinking, and most importantly, try to pull out some practical lessons, some takeaways for anyone out there who's interested in patent law or just like how companies fight these legal battles.
Right, exactly. Because it's one thing to learn about the law in the abstract, but seeing how it plays out in a real case like this is really where the learning happens.
Okay, so where do we even begin with a case like this?
Well, let's start with Primos 567 patent. This was for their diaphragm mouth call, you know, the kind you use to make duck sounds.
Right, the one you put in your mouth.
Yeah. And believe it or not, a big chunk of this case revolved around a single word in the patent, the word engaging.
Just one word. That seems wild. How can so much hinge on a single word?
Well, it's all about how you define it, right? Like, what does engaging actually mean in the context of this patent? The lower court, they interpreted it pretty broadly. They said it basically meant to come into contact with. But Primos, they argued for a much more specific definition. They said it was closer to interlocking, you know, a more secure connection.
So basically, they were arguing over how tightly those parts of the duck call needed to fit together for it to count as their invention.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why claim construction is so important in patent law.
Claim construction. Can you explain that a little for those of us who aren't patent lawyers?
Sure. Claim construction is basically figuring out what all the words in a patent claim actually mean, right? Because those words, they define the boundaries of what the patent actually protects. It's like, you know, drawing a fence around your invention and saying, this is what's mine.
Oh, I see. So the definition of engaging determines how much territory Primos could claim as their own, right?
Exactly. And to figure out what a term like engaging means, courts, they usually start by looking at what we call intrinsic evidence.
Intrinsic evidence. Okay, more legal jargon. Can we break that down a bit?
Okay, so think of it like this. Intrinsic evidence, it's basically all the stuff that makes up the patent itself. The patent claims, the written description, sometimes called the specification, and the prosecution history.
The prosecution history.
Yeah, that's like the paper trail of everything that happened while the patent was being applied for, all those communications between the inventor and the patent office. You know, back and forth, revisions, rejections, until the patent is finally granted.
So it's the whole story of how the patent came to be, right?
Exactly. And the Supreme Court, they made it really clear in a case called Phillips v. AWH Corp. that this intrinsic evidence, it's the primary source that courts should use to understand what the words in a patent claim mean.
So the Supreme Court basically said, start with the patent itself. Makes sense. So in the Primos case, what did this intrinsic evidence tell the Federal Circuit about the word engaging? Did they agree with Primos or the lower court?
Well, in the end, they sided with the lower court. They decided engaging just meant to come into contact with that broader definition.
Interesting. So why do you think they went that way?
A couple of reasons. One was the way the claim was written. The claim, it used both the word engaging and the word sealing. And legally speaking, courts assume that different words in a patent claim, they have different meanings.
Yeah, makes sense. If you're going to use two different words, they probably should mean different things.
Right. So if engaging meant interlocking, like a really secure fit, then having sealing in the claim would be kind of redundant.
Yeah, because if they're interlocking, they're pretty much already sealed, right?
Exactly. So the Federal Circuit, they looked at that and said, okay, maybe engaging shouldn't be interpreted so narrowly.
Okay, I'm following you. So one reason was about avoiding redundancy in the claim language. What was the other reason they went with the broader definition of engaging?
Well, They also looked at those patent drawings you mentioned earlier, the ones that show how the invention is supposed to work. And in those drawings, the parts that were described as engaging, they were just touching. There wasn't any complex interlocking mechanism.
Oh, I see. So if they'd gone with Primos's definition of engaging as interlocking, it would have actually excluded the very design that Primos showed in their own patent.
Exactly. That's what the court pointed out. They said, and I'm quoting here, "Interpreting engaging to mean interlocking would exclude the embodiment shown in the figure and is not consistent with the rest of the specification, which does not suggest an interlocking relationship between the roof of a mouth and the mouth call."
Wow, that's a pretty clear statement.
Yeah, it really shows you how important it is to have all those details in your patent document line up.
Absolutely. All right, so we've tackled engaging. I feel like we've spent a good chunk of time on that one word.
Yeah, but it's a perfect example of how much can ride on a single word in a patent.
Right. Okay, let's move on. What else was going on in this case?
Well, there's another interesting aspect to this case. It involves Primos's 578 patent, a different one from the one with engaging. And here things get a little trickier. The jury actually found that Hunter's Specialties product, this thing called a tone trough, did infringe on Primos's patent, but not in a direct way. It was through something called the doctrine of equivalence.
Doctrine of equivalence. Now, that sounds like a whole other can of worms. Can you explain what that's all about?
Sure. So imagine someone comes up with a product that's basically identical to yours, except they've made a few tiny, insignificant changes. Just enough to avoid literally copying your patent claims. But the product still basically does the same thing in the same way.
Sounds pretty sneaky.
Yeah, it can be. That's where the doctrine of equivalence comes in. It says even if something isn't a literal copy, if it functions in basically the same way to achieve the same result, it can still be considered infringement.
Oh, I see. So in this case, Primos is saying, yeah, Hunter's tone trough might look a little different, but it works the same way as our patented invention, so they're still infringing.
Yeah, that's the gist of it. Primos argued that even though Hunter's design used a dome shape instead of a plate, like their patent described, it was still basically equivalent. It served the same purpose.
Makes sense, but I'm guessing Hunter's Specialties didn't just roll over and accept that, right?
Of course not. They had a pretty clever counterargument. They brought up this thing called prosecution history estoppel. Now, that's a mouthful.
But yeah, maybe unpack that one a little for us.
Here's the basic idea. Sometimes when you're applying for patent, you have to narrow down your claims to get it approved. And maybe the patent office says your invention is too broad or overlaps with existing patents. So you have to give up some ground, make your claims more specific to get that patent granted.
I'm with you.
Now, prosecution history estoppel basically says that if you've narrowed your claims during that application process, you can't later turn around and try to broaden them again through the doctrine of equivalence.
So it's like, you made your bed, now you gotta lie in it.
Huh, exactly. You can't go back on those concessions you made to get the patent. So in this case, Hunter's Specialties was pointing to the fact that Primos had changed their claim term plate to differentially spaced during the patent application process. And they were basically arguing that this change should prevent Primos from now saying their dome was equivalent to the plate.
Okay, so Hunter's was using Primos' own history against them. Pretty smart.
Yeah, it's a common legal strategy. And they were relying on a Supreme Court case called Festo Corp v. Shokutsu Kinzoku Kogyo Kabushiki Co., which specifically deals with how those kinds of amendments to your claims can limit your options later on.
Sounds like a pretty strong argument. Did the Federal Circuit buy it?
Well, not quite. They saw an important exception at play here. They said that Primos' amendment, changing plate to differentially spaced, wasn't directly related to the dome shape that Hunter's was using. It was more about the spacing of the elements, not the overall form.
Ah, so it wasn't that Primos had given up any ground related to the shape of the thing, just the spacing.
Right, and the court called this a tangential amendment. Basically, they said because the dome still had that differentially spaced element, the amendment was kind of beside the point. It didn't really address the specific design element that Primos was now calling equivalent.
Interesting. So even though they changed the language in their claim, it didn't actually stop them from using the doctrine of equivalence in this specific instance.
Correct. And the Federal Circuit, they actually spelled this out pretty clearly. They said, and I'm quoting here, because the accused device's dome includes the spacing, the amendment was merely tangential to the contested element in the accused device, and thus prosecution history estoppel does not apply to prevent the application of the doctrine of equivalence.
Gotcha. So there are exceptions to this prosecution history estoppel thing. It's not a simple black and white rule.
Nope, patent law is full of nuances.
So Primos was in the clear then?
Well, not so fast. There's another rule they had to contend with, the all limitations rule. This rule says you can't use the doctrine of equivalence to completely wipe out an entire limitation in your patent claim.
So you can't just say dome and plate are the same if plate was a specific requirement in your patent.
Exactly. And Hunter Specialties could have argued that, you know, a dome is so different from a plate that calling them equivalent basically ignores the whole plate limitation.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what did the court say about that?
Well, they sided with Primos again. They said that while a dome and a plate are definitely different shapes, the dome in Hunter's call still did basically the same thing. It performed a similar function, you know, helping to create those duck sounds. So they didn't see it as eliminating the plate limitation entirely.
So basically they were saying a dome can still be a kind of plate, at least in this context.
Yeah, in a functional sense. And again, the court was pretty specific in their language. Here's the quote. Thus, because Primos's theory of equivalence, i.e. that a dome is equivalent to the claimed plate, does not effectively eliminate the plate limitation in its entirety, it does not violate the all limitations rule.
Okay, so the doctrine of equivalence held up and the court found infringement on that 578 patent. But wait, there was one more twist in this case, right? Something about a late piece of evidence.
Right. This is where the case takes a turn into procedural stuff. Hunter Specialties, they tried to introduce this new piece of evidence late in the game. It was this thing called the aluminum flap call.
Oh, what was that all about?
Well, they were trying to use it as prior art.
Prior art. Remind me what that means again.
Sure. Prior art basically means an invention that already existed before the patent in question was filed. So if you could show that something very similar to the patented invention was already out there, it can potentially invalidate the patent.
Oh, so Hunters was trying to say, hey, this aluminum flap call, it's basically the same as Primos's invention, so their patents shouldn't count.
Exactly. The problem was, they tried to introduce this evidence super late in the process, after the deadline for disclosing evidence had already passed.
Oof, that sounds like a bit of a legal no-no.
It can be, yeah. It goes against the idea of procedural fairness. You know, both sides need to have a fair chance to review all the evidence and build their case. Primos wouldn't have had enough time to properly investigate this aluminum flap call and figure out how to respond.
Yeah, that makes sense. So did the court allow this late evidence?
Nope. They shut it down. Both the district court and the federal circuit, they agreed that this late introduction of evidence would be unfair to Primos.
Seems reasonable.
It is. And it's a good reminder that these procedural rules, they're not just arbitrary. They exist for a reason, to make sure everyone gets a fair shake.
And I bet that happens a lot, people trying to sneak things in at the last minute.
It does happen. And the federal circuit, they were very clear about their reasoning here. They said, and I'm quoting again, it was well within the district court's province to determine that because the aluminum flap call was not identified as potential prior art until after discovery had closed and shortly before trial commenced, it would then be unfair to permit its introduction into evidence. So lesson learned, right? Stick to the deadlines.
Absolutely. You got to play by the rules. Okay, so we've covered claim construction, the doctrine of equivalence, and procedural fairness. Anything else major we need to hit before we wrap up?
Oh, there's one more thing. The case also touched on the jury's finding of willful infringement for that 567 patent and some of the instructions that the jury was given during the trial. Remember that one, the first patent we discussed?
Yeah, the engaging patent. So what happened there?
Well, the jury found that Hunter Specialties had willfully infringed on Primos's 567 patent, meaning they knew they were doing something wrong and did it anyway. And the federal circuit, they upheld that finding. They agreed with the district court's use of the totality of circumstances standard, which is the typical legal way to decide if someone was deliberately infringing.
Okay, so they were intentionally stepping on Primos' toes. What about those jury instructions you mentioned? Was there something controversial there?
It wasn't a huge deal in the grand scheme of things, but it's worth mentioning. During the trial, one of the witnesses from Hunter Specialties, he decided to invoke attorney-client privilege and refused to answer certain questions.
Oh, so he was like, I can't talk about that. It's confidential.
Exactly. And in response to that, the district court, they gave the jury a specific instruction. It's called an adverse inference instruction. Basically, they told the jury they were allowed to draw a negative conclusion from that witness's refusal to answer, you know, assume he was hiding something.
Ah, so the jury was told they could basically hold that silence against Hunter Specialties.
In a way, yes. But the Federal Circuit, they reviewed this and said it wasn't a big problem. They emphasized that this instruction was very specific, it only applied to that one witness, and it didn't suggest that Hunter Specialties as a whole was trying to hide information.
Got it. So it was a narrow instruction, didn't unfairly sway the jury.
Right. So we've covered a lot of ground here. We've gone through claim construction, the doctrine of equivalence, procedural fairness, willful infringement, and even jury instructions. And it all stemmed from this one case about duck calls.
It really shows you how much complexity there can be, even in seemingly simple legal cases.
It does. So for all our listeners out there, especially the law students, what are some key takeaways from all this? What should we keep in mind?
Yeah, what have we learned?
Well, first and foremost, I think this case really drives home the importance of the patent document itself. You know, when you're trying to understand what a patent claim means, the first place to look is at the claims, the written description, and the prosecution history. All that intrinsic evidence, that's what the Federal Circuit stressed here. They actually said, and I'm quoting here, "In ascertaining the ordinary and customary meaning of a claim term, a court's primary focus should be on the intrinsic evidence of record, viz. The claims, the specification, and, if in evidence, the prosecution history." Makes sense. Start with the source, right?
Yeah.
Don't jump to outside interpretations. Right. And another big takeaway, it's about prosecution history estoppel. Remember that?
Yeah, the whole you can't broaden your claims after you narrow them to get the patent.
Exactly. And what we learned here is that it's not a simple rule. There are exceptions. If the amendment you made during the patent process wasn't directly related to the element of the allegedly infringing product, then you might still be able to use the doctrine of equivalence.
So even if you had to narrow your patent claims initially, you're not necessarily boxed in forever.
Right. It all comes down to the specifics of the amendment and how it relates to the alleged infringement.
Makes you realize how much those tiny details matter in patent law.
Absolutely. And the last takeaway, I think, is about procedural fairness. You got to play by the rules in litigation. Meeting deadlines, disclosing evidence properly, all of that is super important. Because if you try to pull a fast one, the court's not going to be happy, and it could really hurt your case.
Agreed. It's all about a level playing field.
Exactly. So Trimos v. Hunter Specialties, it's a case about duck calls. But it really gives us a fantastic look into some pretty fundamental aspects of patent law.
It does. We've seen how patent claims are interpreted, how the doctrine of equivalence works, and how important it is to follow the rules of the game in litigation.
And it also highlights the importance of strategy, right? Both in drafting your patents and in litigating them.
Totally. I mean, we've seen how much legal argument can hinge on a single word, like engaging, or the seemingly subtle difference between a plate and a dome.
Right. And that's why it's crucial to sweat the small stuff. Whether you're an inventor, a lawyer, or anyone involved in innovation, it's about paying attention to the details, being precise with your language, and thinking several steps ahead.
Well said. And on that note, we'll leave you with this thought. This case, it shows how much scrutiny a single word or a small design choice can face. So think about this. How does this level of scrutiny apply to other areas of law, or even beyond law, to innovation in general? That's something to ponder.
Great question. That's all for today. Thanks for joining our deep dive.
See you next time.